Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Landry Ayers. Today, we'll be soaring into the vast expanse of the galaxy's outer rim, past the reach of the New Republic, and among the decrepit, crumbling outlaw planets once under the yoke of the now fallen Empire. We'll be talking about none other than the Mandalorian. This is the way. Joining me in this den of scum and villainy are an array of dastardly crooks, including returning guest, Star Wars superfan Nicholas Armstrong.
Happy to be here.
Cato Research Fellow Pat Eddington.
Greetings.
The Cato Institute's Director of Health Policy Studies, Michael Cannon.
This is the way.
And host of the Beltway Banthas podcast and author of the forthcoming How the Force Can Fix the World, Stephen Kent.
The Force is strong on this call.
Thank you all for joining me today. Sadly, Natalie could not be with us, but I think I'll be able to handle this for today. When Natalie is away, the nerds will talk about Star Wars. And I think compared to some of our previous Star Wars episodes, I'm hoping that we'll be in a little bit more consensus about how much we enjoyed this compared to The Rise of Skywalker, which actually happened just about a year ago today. The Mandalorian, which as of our recording has just finished season two, is pretty clearly, even more so than previous Star Wars movies, a Western, really, even though it is in space. And a lot of the Star Wars movies have that Western influence and are kind of cowboy films. I think more than any other, it really tries to emulate that genre. Between the shootout on the main avenue on Corvo with the gunslinger or meeting Marshal Cobb Vanth on Mos Pelgo, what does the stylistic choice of that genre and really hammering it home do for the setting and the characters that previous installments in the series have not done before, or perhaps not done to the extent that The Mandalorian has?
Well, I'll jump in, Landry. I think what makes The Mandalorian work, from my perspective, is that it is largely character-driven. I think that Star Wars is always at its best when it's character-driven. I think that's what made episodes 4 and 5 work so well. To a lesser extent, the rest of the universe. But the Western genre with The Mandalorian puts Mando, Din Djarin, in these situations where he's sort of wandering through this untamed wasteland of the universe, and all of these experiences that he's encountering with different characters in different places are having this slow transformative effect on his character. Certainly the biggest transformative effect comes from Grogu and the attachment that he develops to Grogu, but there are others along the way that you can see sort of wreaking this change in his character that I think is what makes The Mandalorian compelling.
One of the things that I think about the stylistic choices with The Mandalorian, and I say this as a contemptible millennial who has never sat down to watch a Clint Eastwood Western. I don't care about its like Western, you know, appeal, about like how they sort of echo like, you know, samurai stories. And, you know, there's kind of like all this film nerd criticism that goes into like the movie reviewing industry. And they're like, oh, well, you might have noticed in the episode with Ahsoka when she stands off with the lady, the ex-imperial, and they have this moment in the garden that it's like, you know, a nod to samurai films. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's just really beautiful. And that's what matters, is that like those genres make space for really beautiful cinematography and focus on landscapes. And not just that, like Michael noted, is moving between environments. Like you've got this character who is on an adventure, and then every episode is like a serial. Like today, the Mandalorian is solving this problem. Tomorrow, the Mandalorian is 3 days later and he's solving this problem. And it's like a comic book in some ways. And that kind of storytelling works really well for Star Wars. Just like I think with George Lucas, like he liked that about Buck Rogers and all that kind of stuff. Like that's Star Wars format at its best.
Yeah, I think that the beauty of it is it does let you explore so much of the galaxy. You kind of get on your horse, the lamentably lost Razor Crest, and fly around to a new town and new characters, and you get to meet weird, zany mechanics and interact with Tusken Raiders on one episode and meet a frog lady in the next one. And it doesn't interrupt the narrative, because the narrative is, as Stephen said, hopping from place to place on your journey. I think that's one of the beautiful things about Westerns, is it's sort of moving through the West. It's not just one place and one person. It's sort of the collection of the tapestry of the West, which in Star Wars is a beautiful opportunity for storytelling, as long as you can spread out a little, but keep focused on that character.
So as the oldest guy on this particular podcast, I'm happy to say that I fully appreciate the Western angle of this. I have always been and remain a huge Clint Eastwood fan. I will say though that this is not it's not exactly like the Outlaw Josie Wales. Definitely not like High Plains Drifter. But what I think is also compelling for me, it's not just this development, this character development that has been alluded to. But we are getting like some, for those who are listening to this, if you've seen everything, okay, if you have seen the Clone Wars animated series, if you've seen Star Wars Rebels animated series, if you've seen all the movies up to this point in time, then you are probably well aware that there are some massive spoilers and foreshadowing of things to come that have been sprinkled all throughout these first two seasons. And that's, I think, the part that has me really excited. My biggest complaint, quite frankly, with the movies, certainly this last trilogy, has been that they have had people at the helm who clearly did not understand Star Wars, and at least to me. J.J. Abrams is a great director, but the only guy that they've had helm a film that's known what the hell he's doing is Gareth Edwards.
Yep.
And that's Rogue One, right? Rogue One is my favorite film in the entire canon, in the entire series. And I think a big reason for it is because it has this kind of grit that is in The Mandalorian. And that, to me, that's what makes The Mandalorian feel so real. I mean, I think we all know that the very best of science fiction simply uses the future and any associated technology as a backdrop, right? To actually tell real stories, real human stories. And I think so far they've done a tremendous job with this series in doing that. I am not a fan, A, of the name Grogu. It does not roll off the tongue. I'm sorry, it just doesn't.
It doesn't begin with a Y?
It does not begin with a Y, or at least doesn't have a Y in it. And then I am extremely enraged that they destroyed the Razor Crest. I am not okay with that. That was becoming an iconic ship, and I want to see how that problem gets fixed. Anyway.
One thing that you raised, Pat, and also that I think was introduced by canon there, was the idea that Rogue One and The Mandalorian have done an amazing job of creating even more complex, realistic human stories set in the Star Wars universe. It uses that as a backdrop to tell really compelling stories about people, or aliens, if you don't want to consider them people, but beings that are undergoing intense character arcs, like Canon mentioned, in this wasteland, this vast expanse of unknowable. I mean, you could view it as the sort of untamed West, to sort of play into that mythos that they're invoking, but it's space, and obviously sci-fi and Western have always kind of played with each other in those tropes in that way, but they do this, I think, in a few different ways, and I think it really is shown in the penultimate episodes of both seasons so far of The Mandalorian. In season one, you have Werner Herzog's the client character, who says the line at one point, "The Empire improves every system it touches. You know, judge it by any metric, safety, prosperity, trade, opportunity, peace. You compare imperial rule to what's happening now. Look outside. Is the world really more peaceful since the revolution? I see nothing but death and chaos." And entirely sure, that is a highly biased, very one-sided way of looking at things. But it does raise the question that a lot of people seeing the fallout of the rebels and the blowing up of the Death Star might see when they look at what is left in the galaxy, especially when you go to places like the Outer Rim. I mean, Greef Karga at one point, Carl Weathers at one point says, you know, I wish they would just leave the Outer Rim alone so that we can sort of do this on our own. It's like an oddly like libertarian moment for a Star Wars movie, so outright. But then it also in season two, episode seven, which is, I think, my favorite episode in the entire series so far. I think it's got great action and amazing character arcs when you've got Mayfeld coming back and sort of battling with his demons and what he's done in the past and how he changes, and Din Djarin, we finally see him remove his helmet in front of someone and he gives him a pass. He says, you know, Empire, New Republic, it's all the same to these people. Somewhere, someone in the galaxy is ruling, and there are others that are being ruled. It comes down to power and how it is being exercised. Does the Star Wars universe in general, in your experience, and maybe specifically The Mandalorian, come down on either side about how it feels about not maybe just power, but state power and how it's used? Like, is the New Republic any better than the Empire? Is what the Imperial Guard on that ship when they try and kidnap Dr. Pershing right, where he says, like, it's basically an act of terrorism that when they blow up the Death Star? Like, I think about that conversation that happens in Clerks when they're talking about, you know, in A New Hope, there was, you know, it was already built. It was staffed by stormtroopers and Imperials when they blew up the Death Star. So great, evil's defeated. But in Return of the Jedi, it was still under construction. They must have had independent contractors there who were innocent, and you blew them up. So, but it sort of celebrates everything. Does Star Wars come down on a side about that type of broad issue?
I think in the original trilogy, the answer was a clear-cut yes, right? What they've done with The Mandalorian especially is they've kind of, you know, muddied the waters a little bit. And I think in the background, in the backdrop, I think the answer is probably still yes. But they're doing a great job of kind of showing the gray areas. And you see a guy like Bill Burr, and what a tremendous addition to the cast. I'm hoping that they'll actually make him a regular in season three, because he has those terrific comedic chops, but at the same time, he showed, in my view at least, an enormous depth as a serious dramatic actor, specifically Landry with that scene in the little Imperial, I'll put that in quotation
marks, the K&W cafeteria.
Yeah, exactly. it was just a great exchange, a great setup. And then the way that he blew that officer away, and then the way that Pascal played that scene, it's like you really bought that the Mando is thinking, holy shit, I can't believe he just did that. We're going to have to like really shoot our way out of here.
And it's because he really had this moment of, I think, clarity. And this is where Star Wars tries to do both things, and they're both important. So Star Wars is radically committed to the from a certain point of view ideology of A New Hope put forward by Ben Kenobi. Like, they have stuck to this throughout their entire run. The very fact that you learn that you have an empire that was once a republic, that clone troopers are what become the stormtroopers, that you have heroes who become villains. This is Star Wars constantly telling you that, you know, the path of good intentions, you're always just like one angry, you know, breath away from becoming the bad guy in this story. And they have stuck to that throughout. And if they wanted to have a message about good intentions and government naturally leading to good outcomes, they would have had the New Republic be successful. And they didn't. They blew them up. They blew them up as soon as they canonized the New Republic. And it's because Star Wars is constantly driven by, I think, the correct view of human nature, which is that it is more going in a circle, and we're not constantly just progressing and getting better. I don't hold that view. I don't hold the human progress view of humankind. I know that's controversial on a Cato podcast, but you know,
I share it with you.
Star Wars, I think, gets that right. But Bill Burr's character has that moment of clarity listening to Lieutenant Hess talk about Operation Sender and lives that need to be taken for a greater good. And he shoots the guy in a moment of anger because there is evil. There, not everything is subjective. Not everything's gray. Star Wars tries to tell you, like, look, like everybody tries to do their best, but you can be evil.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because to me, the fundamental statement in Star Wars is that power is dangerous and that too much of the power can lead you to the dark side. That thirst for power is the fundamental conflict in Star Wars. So as it applies to governments, it's the same thing. I mean, we have the sort of don't join from DJ in The Last Jedi that sort of echoes the same question, the same conflict posed in the penultimate episode of season 2 for Mandalorian, that, hey, look, everyone is doing bad things. Like, what are you chasing? What are you going after? Like, don't be part of this. To me, I think we'll actually see more of this in one of the new series, the Rangers of the New Republic. It's going to be Space Cops, sounds like. Which is where I suspect we'll find more Bill Burr, for good or ill, depending on where you fall on that. but he just implies the existence of Space Boston, which, to, you know, kind of blows my mind. But yeah, I think that quest for power is one of the interesting things for me is, can states be good?
And I think I agree with what everyone has said about the Star Wars universe's view of human nature. You know, what made the original trilogy so compelling from a character development point of view was you had this cartoonishly evil, you know, Lord Vader, who then you find out that he's Luke's father. Then he turns away from the dark side to the light. And there is this sort of, there's this sort of tension and expectation that the original trilogy built up that this was actually a good person all along. And it left us with this question, how did he become so evil? And that's why we nerds who were in the theaters in 1977 were dying for The Phantom Menace to come out, dying for this story to be told about how a good person, as George Lucas even put it in interviews, how a good person thinking he's doing good ends up turning toward evil and becoming so just inexplicably evil. And then the prequels came along and completely botched that. I mean, it was totally unconvincing. The performances, the writing, it was not a plausible conversion from this, you know, cute little boy on Tatooine to this Dark Lord of the Sith who's slaughtering Padawans. The things that we're seeing now in Rogue One, in The Mandalorian, where they are consciously trying to explain from the perspective of these people who you may think are evil, why they're doing the things that they are doing, really makes the series more compelling, is a much more accurate statement of human nature, and is also, you know, and is therefore a more accurate reflection of politics, because even the fascists, even the Nazis, even the communists thought that they were doing good. And Solzhenitsyn says, if you really want someone to do evil, you got to give them an ideology that tells them that's doing good. And so I think that's what makes this so compelling for me. And the question of what does Star Wars say about the state and about state power? I think it's basically that power is dangerous. The prequels hinted in this direction, but again, in a cartoonish way when Emperor Palpatine said the Jedi don't want to get rid of their power. But I just want to say that as an economist, one thing that bothers me about the Star Wars universe is, and what it has to say about state power and, you know, whether the Empire is good for, helps every place it touches is, here you've got a galaxy with how many systems? Thousands of planets and civilizations across this galaxy. Okay. This is a fantastic opportunity for federalism to conduct experiments and have the economists measure what kinds of institutional arrangements produce the best outcomes. And we've seen nothing of this. We haven't heard from any of them. It's always just fighting for power, power, power. So I guess what I'm putting in a plug for is the Star Wars universe needs more economists.
the prequels, I mean, the prequels touched a little bit, and we know this because of the opening scroll, like why we got into conflict in the first place, why a cycle of new governments and war was set off after 1,000 years of relative peace under the Republic. Trade and openness and economic arrangements between all the planets of the galaxy was making things work, but corruption and opulence were festering on Coruscant. And one of the greatest installations to the new canon that I have picked out is right after the Return of the Jedi, or I guess it takes place around the time of the Mandalorian when the New Republic is being built. The New Republic does have political parties, which the Old Republic did not, which is bizarre. It's easy to see how it just fell into oligarchy, because nobody was there for anything but self-interest. But the New Republic had political parties, the populists and the centrists. Leia headed up the populist party, which was the equivalent of a states' rights party. It was really adamant about local control, the New Republic not dictating what sort of arrangements could be made between different planets and allowing planets to go their own way if they wanted to. And then you had the centrists, who really believed in the idea of the Empire and a unitary galactic government, but they wanted to do it right this time.
And sort of like the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists.
Yeah, and it's really, really cool that they actually built that out. And, you know, when I think about what went wrong with the prequels, I'm a little rebellious against the idea that they were a complete failure. But what Star Wars has always done is they've planted mile markers in the timeline and gone, all right, we're going to do the Galactic Civil War, we're going to do the Clone Wars, and then we're going to do whatever the prequel trilogy or the sequel trilogy was, the Battle Against the First Order, and then we're going to fill in the gaps. And they filled in the prequel gaps with the Clone Wars TV series, gave us explanations for how Anakin could have become so corrupt and dark and ready to kill younglings, and then they lay out the sequel trilogy, and now they've offered us all these new installations to help that make sense. Like the entire First Order thing didn't make sense. Now it does. And the Mandalorian is largely responsible for helping it be clear.
And we're getting some really obvious clues, I think, about where a lot of this is going to go in seasons 3 and hopefully beyond. And we get that with towards the very tail end of episode 7 of season 2, after Ahsoka has defeated the former Imperial female, and we find out that the master that she's looking for is none other than Grand Admiral Thrawn from Star Wars Rebels, which leads me to believe that what we have on the one hand is Moff Gideon clearly committed to resurrecting the Empire. And possibly answering to Thrawn, we don't know this yet. But then on the other hand, we have this First Order thing, which is clearly a different faction. So I'm just wondering if this is going to become like a thing, essentially, where we begin to see these different dark side for lack of a better framing, these different dark side factions, essentially, fighting it out to see who comes out on top.
And I think that's a great point. And it goes back to the old extended universe stuff, where you had you had different factions within the Imperial remnants, and you had all these different Imperial officers vying for power in the post-Palpatine era. And Thrawn was a major player and ended up being like the guy who kind of won out in the Imperial remnant wars. And I think that what they've basically now made room for is to rebuild that, where the First Order is the Palpatine loyalist faction. They are the people committed to the idea of the contingency plan, which Hess in episode 7 mentions with Operation Sender. This is after the Emperor is killed. Certain Imperial officers, only a certain core of Imperial officers, have a mandate to start wiping out the Empire. If the Empire was not strong enough to protect its leader, it doesn't deserve to stand. And so they open fire and blow up their own worlds and their own armies. And then those core officers are all to gather in the outer reaches and rebuild. And they're a radical, radical group. That's why they're like so radicalized in The Mandalorian, they're willing to kill themselves or take down their ship if Bo-Katan takes it over. Like, they really believe in this. And so they are the ones who are going to rebuild the First Order. Thrawn is out there doing something different. And we're still going to find out what that is. And I can't wait.
this raises an important question that I think a lot of people are hoping is going to turn out well, but we are obviously still waiting to see. As of right now, Disney has just recently announced another, I think, 11 different series and movies as of recently that we've brought up a few of before. Now, Star Wars, during the sort of prequel trilogy, and even before that, there was the sort of Star Wars Legends, which became the extended universe, and there was a huge amount of content that was being created, a lot of books and things like that. But it did not have the same spotlight on it that the Disney Plus series are going to have. And a lot of people, I think, are wondering, especially after the newest trilogy came out, and it did well commercially, but got sort of mixed feedback from fans and even some of the cast members looking back on it. Is Disney going to burn everyone out on Star Wars, or is this going to, do you think, inject new life into it? Or will Star Wars simply just become another backdrop that eventually sort of loses meaning and it just becomes space? Because they're like, okay, now we've got cops in space, now we've got cowboys in space, now we've got we're gonna get Rogue Squadron, and there's gonna be a, you know, Top Gun in space or something. What is this gonna do for the franchise and, you know, intellectual property like it in the future?
I think it's really important to keep in mind what niche each of those different projects lands in. There's an anime anthology series that's going to come out that I'm going to love, and my dad's not going to watch it. Like, you know, he'll watch it if I go over and make him do it, but he's going to be like, it's a cartoon, I'm not watching that. I'm like, okay, fair enough. And, you know, there's the droids project that's coming out from ILM, and it's basically just about droids. That's all we know. ILM wanted to draw some droids with some new technology, so they're making a droids show. I'm sure that's going to be for my kids. It'll be great. And there's a new tie-in to their book properties for the new High Republic era, which is the golden age of the Jedi. It's supposed to set up the fall from the prequels. You got to have the best before you see the worst. But that's going to be, I think, probably for kids. So then you have these other properties that I suspect will be more like those Netflix Defenders series, the Daredevil, the Luke Cage, where they kind of tie in together. I think the Rangers will probably be something along that. You'll get like Mayfield and Cara Dune and maybe a little Grief Cart, I hope. He's hilarious. He's amazing. And in that way, it can avoid burnout. But I do kind of worry with Ahsoka, Book of Boba Fett, and Mandalorian all kind of running together. That's a lot. So while I think a lot of them can fit in niches, and I think you could probably do a movie or two a year, I do worry about like the same season playing three adult-oriented or family-oriented shows. I think they can make it work, but I think maybe they're trying to make up for some lost time, and it will have some saturation.
I think if you look at the original trilogy, one of the big reasons that it was successful was you had the same team basically in place, right? Kazdan, of course, played an outsized role, I think, in the success of that. And I that just brings me back to the point I made earlier, which is I think that J.J. Abrams is a great director. He never channeled it the way that Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni channel Star Wars. These guys inhabited, especially Favreau. I think he just spent so much time learning from Lucas, being around Lucas, absorbing it all, that their success so far, in my judgment at least, both from a critical standpoint, but probably long-term also from a financial standpoint, is going to stand in contrast in large measure to the folks that were responsible for helming, you know, the last three trilogy movies. So on the one hand, I have some real hope for the series that are coming, because they have spent a lot of time on The Mandalorian really developing a lot of additional directorial talent, right? I mean, taking in a lot of folks who clearly also, I think Bryce Dallas Howard, Ron Howard's daughter, a great actress in her own right, but I think she actually has as much or more talent as a director, quite frankly. I love the episodes that she's done. I like all of them. And I think on the one hand, that's what gives me some hope that we may not have, you know, a burnout or crash and burn kind of situation. But on the other hand, it is possible to have too much of a good thing, and you can go to the well too many times. And I think, you know, Disney has probably felt a lot of pressure knowing that there's going to be a gap between the end of the original trilogy in terms of movies and the next, you know, whatever it's going to be. It just seems to me that some of this stuff is kind of rushed, and I'm hoping that we don't have stuff essentially come out that people are going to go, maybe they shouldn't have like gone there, because they're on a roll. I would hate to see them, you know, crash and burn because they tried to do too much.
Yeah, you want to go out on a high note if you can.
Well, I don't know if you do. You want to get to the point of diminishing returns if you want to maximize your profits. You know, my kids.
You damned economist. You're always on about diminishing returns.
When I told my kids that I was going to be doing for work a podcast about Star Wars, they said, oh, come on, let's go watch The Mandalorian again so you can prepare. Let's go watch Rebels. So let's go watch Clone Wars so you can do your homework. And the fact that, you know, I'm a middle-aged dad who loves Star Wars, and I've got these kids who love Star Wars. And as Nick says, there's all this content for different market segments that like Star Wars and appealing to them in different ways. But just the fact that I've got my kids dragging me to watch this thing that I love suggests, of course, Disney is going to milk this for all it's worth. Of course, they're going to be putting out whatever they think they can make money on. And of course, some of it is going to be garbage. Hopefully what Pat says about what they're learning means that that most of it won't be. And the stuff they don't make money on is stuff that is good, but that people are just, I just don't have time to devote that much of my week to Star Wars. But some of it is going to be, some of it we have to brace ourselves for some of it disappointing us. But as long as they keep putting out the Rogue Ones and the Mandalorians, then that's, I'm all for this process.
We've got a buffet now, and buffets are good. There's a lot of good stuff on there, and you can pick what is for you. The problem with the theatrical release model that Disney was locked into, because that was the pre-COVID world, was that when you put out a theatrical release, it is like a statement. It is saying like, this is the next chapter in Star Wars, like it or hate it. And when you do that, like I felt like a lot of fans, I just felt a little overwhelmed. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm taking this Rey story, and then there's Rogue One, and then there was Solo, and it was just hitting you all the time. And theatrical releases are a lot more of an emotional roller coaster for the Star Wars faithful than series are. Series are like, which part of the story is it that you like? And where do you want to learn a little bit more about the fun factoids of the galaxy? And that's what we have now. I actually don't think that this counts towards oversaturation, because I felt very strongly that we were getting too much a couple of years ago. This new model, I think, will work because it's a new world now.
So COVID saved Star Wars.
Sure.
I eagerly await for Kingdom Hearts 4 when Mickey Mouse joins the Star Wars world and summons his lightsaber Keyblade along with the cast of Final Fantasy and Donald Duck.
Well, we've already got the Elder Wand in The Mandalorian, but you bring up Mickey Mouse, and I wanted to say that the fact that I embrace Disney putting out all of these all this different Star Wars content should not be taken as an indication of where I stand on Disney milking the IP system to keep its copyright of Mickey Mouse immortal and doing the same thing for Star Wars and so forth.
One of the interesting historical things in the franchise is the history of Star Wars, like LucasArts games. They put out a ton of games, and they were largely trash. I own all of them, and I've played all of them, but most of them are bad. They're like half-conceived reskins of other games that are better with some really, really good gems. And if that's what we get, it's fine. But like I said, I always look at like my dad. He likes Star Wars. He made me keep trying Star Wars till he thought I was like ready to like it or not like it for real. And I liked it. But he's not going to watch like the Freemaker Adventures for Lego, like their fun family show. Just like he wasn't going to play Galactic Assault Force Commander Battlegrounds reskin of like Red Alert. He's not going to. That's the other stuff that's always on the shelf. The big releases, the Knights of the Old Republic, things that have changed the franchise, that's what we're hoping for. But there is also that point where you're like, oh, it's a Star Wars game. Like, I don't know. You need to keep having those big hits. And I'm hopeful that we can weather that the same way we weathered the video games. You're like, I'll look at the demo. we'll see what it's going to be. You know, I'll check out the first episode. Oh, that's a kid's show. Maybe I'll just let it sit. But yeah, I think there is precedent for Star Wars thriving, even in an ecosystem where it's full of maybe stretched budgets, which, you know, we saw a little bit, I think, this season on Mandalorian, and maybe overambition.
Nick, I have a question for you. How do you think they are going to make audiences aware of what projects are keystone projects? Like, because I think like the series are now filling the roles that comics and books used to play for deep fans. Oh, I know extra little things about the universe because I go to conventions and I read every comic. And that's different from your trilogy fans, the people who all love Star Wars trilogy movies. But how in this model, do they make it known you need to watch this show? This is the next big thing in Star Wars.
I think that's my big concern is because it's all on Disney Plus. You can put it in different like menus, and you can advertise like kind of like Netflix does, like on boot up. If you have your kids' account, it's like, hey, the new Star Wars Resistance cartoon. But like, I get the new Mando stuff. I guess you can do that, but historically, it's like Cartoon Network plays the Clone Wars. And so you know who that audience is. It's preteens and teens. That's who it's targeting. Like Toonami or whatever, like Adult Swim. I don't know. I don't watch it anymore. But when you're a kid, you know the programming blocks, you know how to target. But it's all one channel. I don't know, because Disney is such a monolith with its Disney brand. So I don't know where the spaces fit in that. And it's one of the things that does very much concern me. Like, you can't spin it off to, like, Amazon Prime like Lucas would have done. Like, I don't know, Amazon Prime gets some weird kids show. Go make it. Cool. We'll take our cut.
What does The Mandalorian do about the theme of parenting and fatherhood that the previous installments have done? Because obviously, fatherhood specifically is a huge like cornerstone as a theme to this entire franchise with Luke and Anakin, etc. And now we have this sort of found family relationship between the Mandalorian and the child, and it becomes this sort of strange what was a bounty hunter bounty relationship grows into, I think, one of the more positive family relationships that we see in the franchise. What is the significance of that?
Well, fatherhood is a huge theme of the entire universe. I mean, most of your main characters are damaged in some way because they didn't have a father, or because their father abandoned them in some way or was separated from them. So Din Djarin is one of those, you know. He lost his father, was killed at a young age. And so it will be interesting to see how they develop this theme and, and you know, maybe I'm struggling to think of a healthy parent-child relationship in the universe. Obviously, Leia was raised by loving parents, but we don't see much of them. We don't see much of that relationship. So it'll be interesting to see how they do that.
So we're talking here about our first kind of interspecies adopted family kind of situation here, right? And we also see some parallels. You know, Michael alluded to the whole issue of violence early in Din Djarin's life, and it's literally in the last episode of season one where you get the maximum length flashback, and you actually see that, oh wow, he's rescued by Clan Vizsla, he's rescued by Death Watch. This is like a major thing. So okay, that's a big deal. But then you see that it's separatist heavy attack droids and separatist attack ships. So there's your Clone Wars tie-in right there. And then you go back to, you know, little Grogu. And this is a little guy who is saved somehow during the Purge, you know, the most violent act to ever take place in the Jedi Temple. So there's, you're talking about two characters here from a young age who wound up being scarred by violence and having to deal with violence. And they're still having to deal with violence literally in every episode, you know, and how they come to terms with that, how they essentially watch each other's back. And then at the end of season two, we get this break and it leaves you wondering, okay, how is this relationship going to actually come back together? Because I left that episode with a strong sense that Din Djarin absolutely did not really want to let the kid go. And I had the sense that the kid himself was like, okay, I have to do this, but right. So how are they going to, like, you know, wind up bringing that back together? That's what I can't even conceive now of the Mandalorian going forward as a series without the two of them together. I have a lot of difficulty, like, figuring out how that works.
Yeah, they'll certainly have to sell us on it. I think season three, we're going to Mandalore for the battle for the throne of that planet. But on fatherhood and parenthood, I think I want to make a point, and it's going to be kind of a weird arc. But with the Mandalorian, they were telling a story throughout about him conquering his dogma and realizing that he was like in some weird, you know, Mandalorian cult, and that there is a wider world, and being a Mandalorian is this bigger thing than a religion, like a certain set of rules. And he doesn't know why he's doing it at a certain point. He's like, I was raised this way, but I've discovered this thing that matters to me. Like, I feel love. I feel obligation towards this other thing. And at some point, to save this thing and to love this thing, I'm going to have to give up my dogma. I'm going to have to give up a certain belief I have about taking my helmet off. And that was this message throughout the show about finding what matters in life, like what is your calling and what really makes your heart move. And my thing was Star Wars, and it was one of the last op-eds I wrote on Star Wars for the Examiner, was that Star Wars is begging its fans to grow up. Like they're telling all of us, you need to grow up. You need to find a Padawan. You need to share the Force. Like, you yourself have to also move on in life. And this show, I thought, did a really nice job of offering a story to people about the virtue of being a parent, sharing things that you love with people and finding your calling. Because a lot of Star Wars fans, I think, need to realize that this is not for them at a certain point, it is for their youngling. And it is, the Force is meant to be shared. So I'm glad Star Wars told another story about growing up and purpose and discovery, because that's what makes Star Wars powerful.
I think that's right. And I think the interesting thing of what your parents pass on to you is shown throughout, maybe with a few notable exceptions. But as we've said, the parent relationships are terrible in Star Wars, right? I mean, Saw raises Jin to be his best terrorist at 16, And then she's like, well, these other terrorists might kill you because you know an Imperial. And you're like, oh, well, great job, Saw. So I abandoned you on a planet to fend for yourself. And of course, you know, we have even Leia, Bail Organa, the king of Alderaan, I guess.
Senator.
He uses his daughter as a rebel agent to undermine the very dangerous government. We see her in Rebels running missions. We see her in Rogue One on a transport in the middle of a giant battle, and she's 18. I mean, they're not pulling punches with their kids. There's one really positive relationship, and it's Owen and Beru with Luke. And you see a glimpse of it at the beginning of A New Hope. He's raised by loving adoptive parents who've given him boundaries and taught him morality, and it prepares him for the trials that he has ahead. It's not Obi-Wan, it's not Yoda who prepare him for that moment with his father. It's his adoptive parents.
Huh. Never thought about that.
It's Owen and Beru. And you see in Mandalorian that Grogu has some real darkness. He lashes out like my four-year-old lashes out, right? You don't give her some candy, she really wants it, she gets mad, goes off the handle, you're like, okay, well, I guess so. But you see Grogu not just force-choking Cara Dune when she's arm-wrestling Mando, you also see him fairly sadistically beating up those stormtroopers in Moff Gideon's cruiser. He's not just throwing them to the side so they go away, he's messing with them. He's beating them together in the air. He's screwing with them. There's some darkness there.
Yeah.
And notwithstanding him eating the frog lady's kids.
cultural erasure.
But you know, as you see that conflict coming and you know the darkness that is going to reach him at Luke's Academy, you see another solid parenting a foundation for a potential redemption if Grogu does start to fall in with Kylo or under Palpatine's sort of remote control influence, however that is supposed to work. I don't know. Rise of Skywalker was a mess. But, you know, there are a lot of implications for the darkness ahead and the darkness in Grogu and the amount of healing he has to do. And I think this is the second time that we've seen a parenting relationship prepare you ahead of time for the ability to confront that darkness and maybe even overcome it.
And now for the part of the show where we share all of the other things that we've been enjoying at home. This is Locked In.
So in keeping with the theme of this particular episode, I note that on the day that the last episode of season 2 of The Mandalorian came out, Obsidian released on iOS, Knights of the Old Republic 2, The Sith Lords, which I have been playing obsessively ever since. I've never been like a huge fan of controllers and all the rest of that. So most of my gaming takes place on my iPad. That's probably because also I'm an old man, and I just don't like messing around with the other stuff. But generally not considered to be quite as good as the original. I would take issue with that in some respects, but it's nice now that after having played Knights of the Old Republic, the original, on my iPad, probably over 1,000 times at this point, which tells you that I probably need some kind of help. It's nice to have that extra little thing going on. And then a wide variety, essentially, of books that I'm taking a dive into as well that have absolutely nothing to do with a galaxy far, far away.
I just finished the book by Free Beacon Man of the Year, Matt Iglesias, 1 Billion Americans. I really enjoyed it. I wanted to pick up two books while I was in quarantine this fall and winter, one from inside my bubble and my idea circle and one from out. And Matt Iglesias' 1 Billion Americans was a really, really cool policy manifesto for why we should have a population of 1 billion and challenge challenging a couple of narratives on the right, some narratives on the left that are doom and gloom about population size, and making an optimistic argument about why we should be the largest country and most populous country in the world to have an American century. And I never really thought about some of his arguments in the way that he made them. And it made me think and challenge some of my ideas. And I recommend anybody pick it up.
I am working through Whip by David Bonnier, which is pretty lengthy. So I've been enjoying it. Reading A Little Blue Truck to my son about 1,000 times a day. and for more fun for myself, I've been reading the Stormlight Archive books by Brandon Sanderson, which are sort of epic fantasy that's really about learning to live with, love, and accept yourself and your flaws and sort of move through life. They have like magic and, you know, supernatural fun things, but really there's a very interesting psychological core to the books. And they're also like 50 hours on audio or like 800 to 1,000 pages each. So not a small undertaking, but they're pretty wonderful.
So I recently, and for the first time, I guess I just put it down. I just finished it. I read 1984 by George Orwell. I had read Animal Farm, and I bought it to read to my kids. And they enjoyed it. It was part of a set and came with the 84. So I thought, all right, I'll go ahead and finally read this belatedly. And it was just fantastic. It, you know, my main takeaway from it is that so much of the desire to exert power over other people, even when you think you're doing it for good or right reasons, because you're trying to promote good in the world, at heart, a lot of it is just status. It's just the desire to have status and to assert status by controlling other people. Not sure I'm going to recommend it to the kids just yet. I mean, I've got an 11-year-old and 7-year-old twins, and I think the 11-year-old would enjoy it, except for maybe the torture parts. You know, I think he may have a hard time sleeping after some of that. So I'm going to hold off on recommending that to him. But now I see what all the fuss is about and the larger framework around the boot in a human face forever and other lines that I've been hearing about for so long. But and now I'm looking for what my next book is going to be. As I was late to the game with 1984, I was also late to the game with Schitt's Creek. But I finished that recently, and wow, that was amazing. I can't recommend that highly enough. The talk about character development. I also am, I guess, oh, I guess it's the first. So I've got a guilty pleasure that I've been enjoying, which is Cobra Kai. If you're a child of the 80s and watch The Karate Kid, you will find this ridiculous and often hysterical, only sometimes painful. but also, I was really pleased with, I think it's the third season that of Big Mouth that just wrapped on Netflix. I don't know if you've ever seen Big Mouth. This is an animated series about preteens and sexuality and relationships and so forth, and completely vulgar and wonder just delightfully so. I mean, but with such a wonderful message about such wonderful messages for kids that age. Pity I don't want my kids to watch it at this point because it's so raunchy. But the third season came out. I was anticipating it eagerly, a little worried that it might, you know, suffer from some burnout, but it just didn't. I thought it was terrific. And so if you've seen any of the first two seasons, I think you'll be pleased with the third.
I have been doing a lot of things in my free time over the holidays, especially. I just played a really great little puzzle game that you can get on, I think, pretty much any platform. I played it on Switch, called Superliminal, And you are sort of in a dream, like a waking dream. You're lucid dreaming in this world where you have to go through these series of chambers that involve puzzles about forced perspective and weird, like, shape changing blocks, and you're solving puzzles by picking things up and making them bigger by making them appear farther away. It's very hard to describe, but it is brilliant design, an interesting story, not overwhelming, challenging, and can be done in a day. So I played it in one day. I really, really highly recommend Superliminal. And I also, for Christmas, got myself a couple role-playing game books. I got Morkborg, which is like a really old school, like brutal, high fantasy gothic role-playing game that is influenced by like Nordic black metal. So it's like really brutal, and I'm excited to play it and just die over and over again. But what I really love about it is the book itself is so beautiful and is like this mishmash of crazy graphic design, and is really amazing. And Kids on Bikes, which is a tabletop role-playing game sort of in the vein of Stranger Things, where you play kids in the middle of a small town in the middle of nowhere who get into trouble with secret government bases and possible aliens, and, you know, your kids on your bikes and running around the middle of the woods in Indiana or something. So I'm excited to play that with some friends as soon as I can get some people in person, and we'll be able to play some tabletop games again. Thanks for listening. If you would like to tell us why we're wrong about Star Wars, as is required when listening to anything about the subject, make sure to let us know on Twitter. You can find us at the handle at PopAndLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock, with an E, like the philosopher, Pod. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by me, Landry Ayres, as a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.